Charlie Kala, by Sunny Singh, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nirmi Sheikh. China's blasted President Biden for calling Chinese President Xi Jinping a dictator just days after Secretary of State Antony Blinken met with Xi Jinping in Beijing in an attempt to stabilize relations amid soaring tension over Taiwan and other issues. Blinken was the first U.S. Secretary of State to travel to China since 2018. Biden made his comment on Monday during a private fundraiser. He was talking about the U.S. shooting down a Chinese surveillance balloon in February. Biden said, quote, "And the reason why Xi Jinping got very upset in terms of when I shot that balloon down with two boxcars full of spy equipment in it is he didn't know it was there," Biden said. Biden went on to say that's a, quote, "great embarrassment for dictators when they didn't know what happened," unquote. China's foreign spokesperson, Mao Ning, blasted Biden's comments.
"The relevant remarks by the U.S. side are extremely absurd, irresponsible, and seriously violate basic facts, diplomatic protocol, and China's political dignity. They are an open political provocation. China is strongly dissatisfied with and firmly opposed to this."
To talk more about U.S.-China relations, we're joined by Ho Feng Hong. He's a professor of political economy and sociology at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore. His books include Clash of Empires, From Chimerica to the New Cold War, and The China Boom, Why China Will Not Rule the World. Professor, welcome back to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us. Why don't you start off with this San Francisco fundraiser where Biden made these comments about Xi being a dictator just after Antony Blinken, the Secretary of State, met with Xi in Beijing.
Yes, definitely. That what Biden said, in fact, is true in every word. That Xi Jinping, everybody know that he is a dictator. It's the slow, even the presidential term limit of his role, and he's not elected, and he ruled China authoritarian. In a very authoritarian way. And also Biden said, which is true, is that it would be an embarrassment if Xi Jinping didn't know what is going on about the balloon. But the China's response is right in the sense that it is kind of a violation of diplomatic protocol, because many times, for the sake of maintaining good relations, leaders don't talk about some embarrassing or inconvenient truth to each other. So, but Biden has his own reason to talk like that about Xi Jinping after Blinken visited China, because there is a voice that Blinken is played and is not treated as a kind of equal compared to his predecessors, Mike Pompeo and John Kerry, when they are meeting with Xi. So for the internal domestic audience, and Biden need to shake the impression that he's weak on China. So he needs to talk tough about China after the meeting.
Well, it's an extremely unfortunate, irrespective of the veracity of the claim, it's unfortunate timing, because there were some advances in U.S.-China talks, at least in resuming talks with Blinken's visit to China. If you could elaborate on whose initiative it was that these talks took place in the first place, that Blinken went to China. His initial visit was postponed because of the controversy around the spy balloon, and the fact that China initially wanted to see first the U.S. Treasury Secretary and the Commerce Secretary, but the U.S. had insisted that Blinken would come first.
Yeah, definitely. Right now, China's economy is in bad shape, even after the pandemic. After the opening, that the rebounds, the widely talked about unexpected rebounds in China didn't happen, and Chinese local government and real estate developer and the important enterprise are still heavily in debt. So China really at this time need help from the U.S. economically. So it is why China would want to see some officials from the U.S. that is in charge of the economy. But of course, from the U.S. side of the thing, that the priority of the Biden administration is to minimize the risks of the U.S.-China relations and prevent it from escalating into military conflict. And while U.S. is very occupied with Russian incursion in Ukraine on that front, that U.S. really want to put up some kind of a guardrail to prevent the deterioration of U.S.-China relations. So it is also the consideration behind Biden's sending Blinken to meet with Xi to establish some discussion and communication channel again diplomatically. So it is kind of a situation that the expectation about a talk between Blinken and Xi is a lot high. And after all, it only lasted 35 minutes, including translation. It's very short. But the fact that they start to talk again and then they also agreed to talk more is already a kind of achievement.
And could you talk more about, Professor Hong, the economic dimensions to this meeting? The fact that we're speaking now as Prime Minister Modi is in the U.S. The U.S. is hoping in part to shift part of its manufacturing, the companies, U.S. companies operating in China, to shift manufacturing from China to India. By way of example, at the moment, 95% of iPhones are made in China, but Apple is now considering, is moving manufacturing to India, which is projected to produce 25% of iPhones in just 2 years. China has also hosted several CEOs of tech companies in recent months, including Elon Musk, Jamie Dimon of JP Morgan, and Apple's Tim Cook. So if you could talk about this, the potential shift of a U.S. economic interest from China to India.
Definitely. It is already happening that, for one thing, that the China's demographic and economic structures have been shifting, and we have been hearing a lot of reports about the rising wage in China, also the demographic fall in China, that China is running out of young people, not as much as like 20, 30 years ago when there's a lot of young, educated, low-cost labor. India is going to be the biggest nation demographically in the years to come. And India economy has been growing as a pace now faster than China. So the corporations from the U.S., from Japan and many other parts of the world is already diversifying their operation in China to India and other states in Southeast Asia. But these Southeast Asian countries, none of them are as big demographically and economically than India. So really, India is the place that many corporations trying to move to. Of course, it's very difficult to move all of their operation that is already existing in China to India. It will take time, but the escalating U.S.-China competition and the risk of kind of sanctions, which is like what U.S. imposed and the world imposed on Russia after its invasion of Ukraine, increase the risk that anybody have investment in China. And also the Chinese policy itself, that the crackdown on big tech and its crackdown on due diligence consultancy firms in gathering economic data in China. Also the COVID lockdown experience give many U.S. corporations also a cold feet, and then they really worry that the Chinese economic environment and the government economic policy is no longer as predictable, as friendly to foreign enterprises as before. So it's all these factors add together. We see that even Apple, as you mentioned, is already diversifying their operation to India and also to Vietnam as well to minimize the risks they are going to face in China. So this trend is already happening. So India is the go-to place, and the U.S. Intention to show up its relation, economic and strategic relation with India, is probably going to accelerate this trend.
We just have 30 seconds, Ho Fung Hung, but I wanted to ask you about the role of China when it comes to putting pressure on Russia around the Ukraine war or acting as a mediator. You already have China earlier this year mediating an agreement between Saudi Arabia and Iran. Can you talk about what you see China's role could be?
Yeah. There's little China can do that Chinese government would not. I don't think Chinese government would explicitly help Russian on the military side of the thing. But many companies and private companies or semi-private and state company in China can help Russia, and then the Chinese government can disown them and saying that I don't know about it. So on one thing, China's interest is that the conflict in Ukraine will prolong, so the Western alliance will be occupied with them. But at the same time, China really will be interested in participating in the post-war or kind of a reconstruction in Ukraine to get some of the reconstruction contracts. So China cannot present itself as too much totally on the side of Russia. So China is caught in this kind of a dilemma right now, and so far it is playing relatively well.
Well, Ho Fung Hung, we want to thank you for being with us, professor of political economy and sociology at Johns Hopkins University. His books, Clash of Empires and New Cold War and the China Boom. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, we speak to Joy Bolamwini, the founder of the Algorithmic Justice League, just after she met with President Biden in San Francisco to discuss the dangers of AI. Back in 30 seconds. By Tao and the Get Down, Stay Down. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Amidst the boom in artificial intelligence and growing awareness of its potential risks, President Biden met Tuesday with critics of the technology. He spoke before the closed-door meeting in San Francisco.
The same here today. I want to hear directly from the experts, and these are the world, some of the world's leading experts on this issue. And the intersection of technology and society, who we can provide a range of perspectives for us, and on AI's enormous promise and its risks.
For years, groups like the Algorithmic Justice League have raised alarm about how AI and algorithms can spread racist and sexist biases. The group's founder, Dr. Joy Bolamwini, was among those who met with Biden Tuesday. She's going to join us in a minute. The group recently honored Robert Williams, who's African-American. And in 2020, he was the first known case of police wrongfully arresting someone in the United States based on a false facial recognition hit when Detroit police wrongfully arrested him at his home as his wife and two young daughters watched. He was held overnight in jail, interrogated the next day. Police told him, quote, "The computer must have gotten it wrong," and finally released him. This is part of the acceptance speech by Robert Williams when he received the Gender Shades Justice Award.
I just want to say to anybody who's listening at this point, I guess, just to have the opportunity to let my story be a forewarning to the rest of the world that if it happened to me, it could happen to you, right? I just was a regular. I was at work and was trying to get home, and I got arrested for something that had nothing to do with me, and I wasn't even in the vicinity of the crime when it happened. Right? So it's just that I guess the way the technology is set up, everybody with a driver's license or a state ID is essentially in a photo lineup.
For more, we're joined in Boston by Dr. Joy Bolamwini, founder of the Algorithmic Justice League, just back from that meeting with President Biden on artificial intelligence in San Francisco. She's also featured in the documentary Coded Bias. Dr. Joy Bulamwini, welcome back to Democracy Now! You posted on Twitter before meeting with President Biden that you were looking forward to the meeting to talk about the dangers of AI and what we can do to prevent harms already impacting everyday people, like mortgages and housing, in need of medical treatment, encountering workplace surveillance, and more. I assume, and more, you're talking about issues like this, kind of false racial facial recognition based on AI. Can you talk about the Williams case and so much more, what you discussed with President Biden?
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me. I am actually hopeful after this roundtable with President Biden, because we started the conversation really focused not just on what AI can do, which we've heard a lot about, but centering how it's impacting real people, like we saw with Robert Williams. With the Robert Williams case, what we saw was a case of AI powered biometrics leading to a wrongful arrest. So the research that I've done, and many others have done as well, has shown documented racial bias, gender bias, and other types of biases in facial recognition systems. And when these systems are used in the real world, like we saw with the Robert Williams case, you actually have consequences. So for Robert to be arrested in front of his wife and in front of his two young daughters, you cannot erase those sorts of experiences. And then to be sleeping on a cold slab for 30 hours with just a filthy faucet as a water source. So these are the types of real-world harms that are concerning. And it's also not just on race, right? We have examples of hiring algorithms that have been showing sexist hiring practices then being automated in a way that appears to be neutral. You have people being denied life-saving health care because of biased and inaccurate algorithms. And so I was very excited to see the Biden administration putting the real world harms in the center of this conversation.
And Joy, if you could just explain, you know, how is it that AI has been has these kinds of biases? Because, of course, AI can only reflect what already exists. It's not coming up with something itself. So who are the programmers? How is it that these biases, as you say, not just on race, although particularly on race, but also gender and other issues, how are they embedded within AI systems?
Well, the AI systems that we are seeing on the rise are increasingly pattern recognition systems. And so to teach a machine how to recognize a face or how to produce human-like text, like we're seeing with some of the large language models, what you have are large data sets of examples. Here's a face, here's a sentence, here's a whole book, right? And based on that, you have these systems that can begin to learn different patterns. But if the data itself is biased, or if it contains stereotypes, or if it has toxic content, what you're going to learn is the good, the bad, and the ugly as well when it comes to large language models, for example. And then on the facial recognition side, if you have the underrepresentation of certain populations, it could be people with a darker skin, it could be children for good reason, we don't want their faces in those data sets, then when they're used in the real world, you have several risks. One is misidentification, right? What we saw with Robert Williams' case. But even if these systems were perfectly accurate, now we have to ask, do we want the face to be the last frontier of privacy? Because we're then creating a surveillance state apparatus.
Well, Joy, let's go to a clip from A Coded Bias, the film, a documentary film that you're featured in. This is Sophia Omuja Noble, the author of the book Algorithms of Oppression.
The way we know about algorithmic impact is by looking at the outcomes. For example, when Americans are bet against and selected and optimized for failure, So it's like looking for a particular profile of people who can get a subprime mortgage and kind of betting against their failure and then foreclosing on them and wiping out their wealth. That was an algorithmic game that came out of Wall Street. During the mortgage crisis, you had the largest wipeout of black wealth in the history of the United States. Just like that. This is what I mean by algorithmic oppression. The tyranny of these types of practices of discrimination have just become opaque.
So that's a clip from Coded Bias, a documentary by Shalini Kantaya, which you're featured in. Your comments, Joy.
I think this is a great clip because it's showing that while we have all of these conversations about the possibilities of AI, the reality shows the perils. And what's even more concerning to me right now is in this rush to adopt algorithmic systems, there is a narrative that says we want to have trustworthy AI or we have to have responsible AI. But so many of the popular AI systems that have been built on a foundation of oppression or foundation of unconsented data, some would say stolen data. And so something that was concerning to me at the roundtable was there was an expressed excitement about using AI for education. But then when you looked at the models and the AI systems that were being integrated, these are known models where the companies aren't sharing the training data. Those who have labeled the toxic aspects of that data, right, have spoken out about the exploitative working conditions that they face, being paid, you know, $1 to $2 an hour for doing really traumatic work. And so we can't build responsible AI or expect people to trust in AI systems when we have all of these terrible practices that are undergirding these foundation models. So the foundations themselves need to be excavated and we need to start over.
Dr. Bolognini, can you talk about the project of Algorithmic Justice League that was just launched called a TSA Checkpoint Scorecard, fly.ajl.org, and how people can share their experiences dealing with a new facial recognition program that's being used at several airports across the country?
Absolutely. So the TSA is starting to roll out facial recognition at domestic checkpoints. They're now at 25 airports. And this is concerning because the United States needs to start leading on biometric rights. Just last week, we had EU lawmakers push forward the EU AI Act, which explicitly bans the use of biometric technologies like facial recognition in public spaces, the live use of this technology. We are flying in exactly the opposite direction where people don't even know, right, that they have a choice to opt out. And so what we're doing with the Algorithmic Justice League is we've released the scorecard. So if you have traveled this summer, if you're traveling this summer, please share your experience so we understand, did you give consent? What was your experience if you tried to opt out? Did the technology work for you? I also think that this is a great opportunity for the U.S. government to put into place the blueprint for a Bill of Rights for AI. And so this blueprint came out last year, and it highlights so many of the issues that we've been talking about, which is the need for notice. And we need consent as well, but also we need protections from algorithmic discrimination. We need to know that these systems are safe and effective. We need data privacy so that you can't just snatch people's faces, right? And we need human fallbacks as well. So I think it's a great opportunity for the Biden administration to make true on their promise to make what was put in the blueprint binding through the Office of Management and Budget, and then to push to make the blueprint federal law.
Can I ask you, as it becomes harder to travel longer and longer and longer lines, the other day I was at the airport, guy comes up, I was on an endless line, says, hey, you want to do clear? I will get your information, and then I'll walk you right to the front of the line. It's very hard to say no to that, right, when you're missing your plane. But can you explain what these iris scans are used for and also fingerprints?
Yeah, so when you have systems like CLEAR, I want to make a distinction between you electing to use biometrics when you sign up for CLEAR or TSA PreCheck, where they might be looking at biometrics like your fingerprint, your iris, or your face. This is different from what the TSA has stated in their roadmap, which is to go from pilot to requirement, so that the default option when you go to an airport is that you have to submit your face. This is what's in their roadmap. So agency is absolutely important. The right to refusal is absolutely important. And you just pointed out a dynamic that so many people face. You just made it to the airport. Your flight's about to go and you're given, I don't know, the red pill or the blue pill, and you make a snap decision. And I'm really cautious about these snap decisions because I worry about what I call convenience shackles. So for the few seconds that you might save, or maybe minutes, etc., you now have given up very valuable face data. And we already have examples of data breaches with the government of travelers' face data. So it's not even hypothetical when we're talking about the privacy risk that are here. And the roadmap that the TSA has laid out also talks about then using that face data potentially with other government agencies. So we have to understand that it doesn't just stop at the checkpoint. This is a pilot and a starting point that is going to move us towards more mass surveillance if we don't resist now, which is why we launched fly.ajl.org. That way you can let your voice be heard. You can let your experiences be documented. And it's also not the case, for example, if your face has already been scanned, that there's nothing that can be done. Meta Facebook deleted over 1 billion face prints after a $650 million settlement for violating the Biometric Information Privacy Act of Illinois. This is to say laws do make a difference. And again, I do think the U.S. has an opportunity to lead when it comes to biometric protections, but we are going in the opposite direction right now. So I would call for the federal government to halt TSA's pilot of domestic facial recognition technology at checkpoints. And if you've been subjected to it already, let us hear your story, fly.ajl.org.
And Joy, finally, we just have 30 seconds, but if a Bill of Rights is put in place with the stipulations that you outlined, do you see any benefits of artificial intelligence?
Oh, absolutely. So if we can have ethical AI systems that do help us, for example, with medical breakthroughs, I think that is something that is worth developing. So I am not opposed to beneficial uses of AI, but we don't have to build it in a harmful way. We can enjoy the promise while mitigating the perils.
Joy Bolamwini, we want to thank you so much for being with us, computer scientist, coding expert, founder of the Algorithmic Justice League. To see all our interviews on artificial intelligence, you can go to democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Felsmeichberg, Dina Gezder, Messiah Rhodes, Maria Teresena, Tammy Warrenoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Malkoff, Tamari Astu, Joe John Hamilton, Rabbi Karen, Hani Masood, Sanji Lopez. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
Tune in on July 4th from 8 to 10 p.m. for Sounds of the Sun Volume 1, a summer solstice sound project by Unit Pitt. Curators Catherine DeMontre and Marissa Klangnot Holmes will be your hosts. Featuring an eclectic mix of soundworks by 10 artists, Sounds of the Sun reflect on the solar movement through music, field recordings, storytelling, and experimental audio works. Sounds of the Sun Volume 1 beckons the promise of beach days, AC on max, forest fires, and an excess of sun worship. To learn more, visit unitpit.ca. That's UNITPOTT.ca.